people in the first two rolls. They're not going to see me. just going to have to trust I'm behind here. Every once in a while, I'll just wave and let you know. I'll do this. All right. Well, thank you. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic. And by the grace of a loving God, good sponsorship in AA, I've been sober since March 6th of 1993. And I'd like to take some credit for it, but I really don't think I can. I was one of those guys who had to get her sheet signed when they came to AA. So if you don't get anything out of what I say today, just know this. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't believe in the power that can pull knuckleheads like me back from the gates of insanity and death, like, it's possible. I'm forever grateful for the people who walked before me and for the people in my life who knew that I had a problem before I knew I had a problem. And I want to thank, before I get into this six-hour talk, is it hot in here? Okay, about halfway through, I'm going to take this jacket off. I'm just going to let you ladies, don't get crazy, all right? Just doing the jacket. I'm not going any farther, I know. My wife's in the front row. She will fight for me. So I want to thank Cynthia. I don't know where Cynthia's at. Is Cynthia here? Okay, Cynthia. Amazing. Thank you so much. You've been the sweetest and the kindest, and I appreciate even asking me. I know Lyle was pimping me out to you, but I say you still had to make the decision, and the committee made the decision, and you don't even know how much it warms my heart to be asked to come anywhere in Alcoholics Anonymous, but here is really special. I want to thank Dave. Where's Happy Dave? Is he still happy? Okay. I actually saw Happy Dave not happy for a second last night when a bunch of us were rushing the gates in the back. But Dave has been amazing, and he truly is happy. And Peter met us at the airport and has been a gracious host, driving us around and introducing us to this beautiful city. Thank you, Peter. And the Thursday night dinner was amazing. We're leaving today. Me and my wife came. We brought our kids. We have to get them back into school. We actually cheated, brought them out of school 3 days, you know, and then escaped the cold of Dallas. And it was like 19 degrees. I mean, that's for the Canadians. They're like, whatever. But it's cold in Dallas at 19 degrees. So we're regretting not staying for the sober cruise. But Chloe has to get back to work, and so do I, and my kids have to get back to school. So have fun on the cruise. The dinner on Thursday night was amazing. We met some, was Jennifer and Jane in the house? Where's Jennifer and Jane? Are they still here? Oh, I didn't think they were going to come. My son told them, my son says, you don't need to show up. He's a terrible speaker. You know. That's the kind of love I get in my house. My wife on the way over says, don't suck. They've brought you all the way down here. Don't bring shame to the family name. So, you know. So this has been amazing, and I want to thank Marty. And it was a wonderful talk, Marty. And I always love getting to meet new people and people who, like, trudged the road ahead of me. So thank you, Marty. It was amazing. And Vinoy, I met Vinoy. She didn't remember me, but, you know, whatever. One of the best Al-Anon talks and one of the best Al-Anon speakers I know. So it was really good to see Vinoy. And then my good friend Mari, me and Mari spoke at a conference years ago. Again, she kind of remembered me, but there's something about her accent that is like, isn't it just like you want to just talk to her? So it was really good to see you again, Mari. And the signers here, you guys are amazing. Like, seriously. So, yeah, it's been amazing. In fact, I was watching them, like, it was the facial expressions, it's really good. So, I'm going to get, let's get busy. Let's get, so, I'm going to tell you. Can't touch this. Come on. So so I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I ran into a guy. I knew a guy from Maine. He was here. And I only know it because a guy that I sponsored years ago had sent me a message on Facebook and said, hey, look for Eddie. I posted some pictures of we were out on an excursion. And he said, oh, you're at that conference? I said, yeah, are you coming? He said, no, but my friend Eddie's coming. And he helped me. He was one of those guys who helped me in early sobriety. Keep an eye out for him. And Chloe and I, on the way to the banquet, were like, we got to keep an eye out for this guy, Eddie. We haven't seen him all weekend. And we sit down at our table, and she starts talking about being from Maine, and he's sitting right next to us. I know, right? So I took a picture of me and Eddie, and I sent it to him, and this young man named Lee, who's just a sweetheart of a young man and really passionate about recovery, he's like sent back, said, that heart, like, just makes my heart swell. And then I was in line. This is even weirder. So there's a gentleman, what's his name? David. We're in line at the bank, and this guy's looking at me, and he's kind of like scoping me out. And I thought, like, do I own money? You know, I like one of those things of like, don't know what the deal is. And I think he was trying to figure out if I was my brother, because me and my brother look really alike. And he saw my last initial P, and he said, do you know Dwayne? And he mentioned my last name, I mean, which is a weird last name. And he happened to work with my brother. It's just such a small, and we're all the way down here. This is the Miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have had so many. And the only thing I wanted when I got here is I didn't want to go back to prison. I just did not want to go back to prison. I'm not even sure I wanted to stop drinking. I really don't even know if that was like, I knew I had to stop drinking to not go back to prison, but I'm not sure that I was okay with being sober. I have a condition when I'm sober without a spiritual program of recovery. I'm very uncomfortable sober. I'm like, I'm not okay in my skin. I'm overly anxious. I'm really sensitive. I'm a little bit irritable. I have low patience, I get frustrated. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous calls it spiritual malady. It's a spiritual condition, and alcohol always fixed that for me. And I didn't know that, I just know I didn't like being sober. So I'm amazed, I'm 24 years sober, and I'm amazed that I've been married for 23 years, and I'm amazed that I'm a free man. And I'm not talking free on the outside, because I was in prison way before I went to prison, and I was in prison when I got out of prison. I'm talking about a truly at peace with my innermost self, like really comfortable. So I came, I grew up in Stockton, California. This is nothing, if you're from California, it's a place to be from. It's not a destination place. It's not like, you know, hey, let's go visit Stockton, you know. It's people trying to move out of Stockton. And that's where I was born and raised. And I was born and raised in a really loving home. I can't really complain much about my life. My dad worked at IBM for 33 years. My mom was an accountant. We went on vacations. I knew I was loved. There was drinking and there was alcoholism in the house. I get that. That didn't bother me. I was a latchkey kid. I'm 55. Latchkey, they don't even talk about latchkey anymore. But and if you're young, that means I was raised, both my parents worked, which is so common today. So I was raised pretty much on the streets and by my brothers, not my oldest. He was kind of out the door, but my other brother. And my, I think the only thing drastically that happened as a child was my, and it's a big deal, I was 5, my brother was 7. His name was Chucky, and he died of leukemia. And as a 5-year-old boy, that meant nothing to me, really, you know, because I couldn't comprehend the hospital visits, and I couldn't comprehend my mom crying. I couldn't comprehend the service, the sadness. I wasn't awake to it. Years later, it was to shape some things with me and my mother. And my mom, this is 1967, you know, when kids got cancer, it was a pretty much 80% chance you're going to die if you got leukemia as a child. Now it's the complete opposite. My mom buried her pain in the bottle, and my dad went to work. You know, he was a Korean vet, and he was a worker, and he provided for us. And that was his love. It wasn't, I love you, son. When I was growing up, it was he was working and providing for us. But he showed up for me. So I grew up around alcohol. I started drinking when I was like 10, 11, and I wasn't a daily drinker, obviously, but I would steal from the liquor cabinet, and I'd have fun. And I would go to most of my family lived in Sacramento, so we would go there, my dad's family, and we would have fun. I mean, there would be poker games with all my dad's brothers, big uncles, big parties, cigars and cigarettes and liquor, and I would be the only cousin who would stay up all night and hang out. I just loved sitting on my uncle's lap while he smoked a cigar and drank, and I would sip. I just loved that. But alcohol never became a real issue. I never noticed any real issue until 1980. My parents moved in 1976 to Tucson. And they'll tell you, they moved to Tucson to take a job. My dad got a job. I was 14 years old. My other brothers were all out of the house. I was an only child at this time. Everybody was out. I was 14. 2 years before, I ran away from home, stolen a boat with my brother, not my oldest brother, but my other brother. And, they took us to the, youth center. You know, they do this one of those things. They try to scare you straight and stuff. And my parents really moved to Tucson to get me out of Stockton because they thought that Stockton, if I stayed in Stockton, I was going to end up in prison. Little did they know that they actually took me to Stockton. It was not Stockton. I mean, it took me to Tucson. It wasn't Stockton was not my problem. It was always me. And in 1980, I graduated from high school, and I became a daily drinker. And I'm going to tell you, it didn't seem like it was a problem. I worked hard, and I partied hard, and I had a lot of fun. There was nothing, I didn't get DWIs or OUIs, whatever they call them in your neighborhood. I never got really public intoxication, even though I was publicly intoxicated all the time. I used to hang around with big guys. I loved to hang around big guys, and so I had a big mouth, and I had big friends. So I was great at creating drama. I was not a creator of harmony, trust me. And I'm not one of those guys who said alcohol was just a veil of tears. I had a lot of fun drinking, and then all of a sudden it turned on me. And I don't know what happened. I don't know when it happened. I know that from 19 to 21, and I started engaging in outside issues, and this is early 80s, and I'm in Tucson, Arizona, which is the corridor from Nogales. I mean, they used to call it Cocaine Alley, and it was. And I started engaging in these outside issues, and I only did it because I could drink longer. I thought it would keep me up longer, and it did keep me up longer. I mean, I could stay up late all night and drink and have philosophical discussions about, about paint. I mean, I don't know, But the problem was, and I've kind of always been an entrepreneur. I was I don't make enough money to support this endeavor. And so I started being a drug dealer. And the problem with being a drug dealer and an alcoholic is you make really bad decisions. And I was and I liked the substance I was selling, so that didn't help. And I would do a couple shots of tequila, and then all my goals of about, business plan was out the window, put it that way. And I started about a year-long spiral of getting into this place where I was dying inside, and I didn't even know it. And I've always been an optimist, always. I mean, I really, even in my 40s, I thought, I probably got a few more inches coming. I could get to 5'3". I know, I mean, the only thing growing now is my nose and my forehead, and the hair in your ear, right? That's just, what happens here? But I got into a place where I was feeling kind of hopeless. And I was running around robbing drug dealers, and I was when I say robbing drug dealers, I'm talking sometimes I would roll in with a gun, but that was always people I knew. And I always had a ski mask or a little bandana. I love wearing a bandana. And I would rob people, and I grew up in California. I always wanted to be a Chicano. I always thought, I always have those issues where they just seem so cool. My best friend, his family, they're all low riders and everything, so I would rob drug dealers, and I would do it with an idea. They would know it was me. Hey, Percox, we know it's you. And I'd be like, Ole Vato, you don't know nothing, man. I wasn't right. Anyway, I ended up burning every bridge and getting a bad name in Tucson. And I was sitting around one night, and everybody was going out to the clubs, and I didn't have any money. And my fiance was even going out with her girlfriends, and I was like really bummed out. And I rolled over to my buddy Dave. He was at my house, and I said, "Hey, I got a plan. We can get some money." And Dave was like an engineer student from the University of Arizona who dropped out to hang out with me. And we worked on the same paint crew together. And he's like, "Okay, what's your plan?" I said, "Look, we can rob that Kentucky Fried Chicken. And we can..." And I had it all planned out, you know, on a piece of paper. You know, "We'll go in, we'll do this. I got rope, I got mask, I got duct tape, I got guns. We'll do it. It's all out. Take my roommate's car. We got AC/DC, you know, Back in Black is blaring, you know, like..." So we roll into this place. I'm just saying, so, just so you know, I'm not a gangster, because this is like pathetic. What I'm about ready to share is ridiculous. But the desperation that I had to continue the lies I started, you know, that I was living in. And I remember we walked in, I remember like the lights, you walk into the restaurant and it's like 9 o'clock at night and they kind of just say hi, which meant they know I'm robbing the place. So I went into the bathroom and Dave goes in there and he's like, what, "This is crazy." I said, "Yeah, this is not right. I can't do this." He goes, "Yeah, this is not good, dude." And he goes, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I don't know, let's go eat." So we, you know, that was like my worst three-piece meal ever. You know, like the pathetic, you know, like the existence of my life, like greasy fingers, like really. And now I joke about that, but the truth is that night I went out, that and I dropped Dave off, and we were going to, he said, I'll pick you up tomorrow for work. And I said, okay, but I had no intention of going to work tomorrow. I was done. And I cut off a piece of hose and some duct tape and went out into the desert. And I went deep into the desert. I wasn't going like in a parking lot so somebody would find me. But I was going in to just call it like lights out. And I will always remember that night because how close I was to just saying, I would have gave it all up. The life I have today, I would not have experienced. And I remember sitting in the car, pumping the fumes, I mean, just kind of like going, and I started writing letters, and I wrote a letter to everybody, but the one that got me, and the one that stopped me, and the one that actually made me exit the door was a letter to my mom. And I hadn't had any really selfless thoughts or compassionate actions in a long time, and I could not do that to my mom. She couldn't, I don't think she could have handled having to bury another kid. I just don't think it would have, I think it would have killed her. And so I just got out, and I just got out and walked around trying to figure out what my problem was. And the problem with my mind is, I have this keen intellect that sees the wrong problem, and if I'm focusing on the wrong problem, I'm going to focus on the wrong solution. And the problem that I could identify that night, and it's the only problem, not that I'm drinking every day, not that I'm owed drug dealers all over town, not that I just took the rent money from my roommates and spent it, it's that I just don't have enough money. Like, lack of funds is my dilemma. And that's all I could see. And if lack of money is your dilemma, there's only one solution. And so I drove into town the next morning and I robbed a bank. And I don't know why I robbed the bank. I don't know why I robbed that bank. I don't know. I mean, and to reenact this pathetic experience, put it this way. First off, I got $50 on my first bank robbery. $50. And I got $50 because I asked for $50. And I don't even, look, don't even, there's no even words for that. Like, what is wrong with you? And I'll tell you the truth. So I met my wife, Chloe, my beautiful wife, Chloe. If you've met her, she's definitely made me a better man. And she was still suspect. I mean, she met my parents, and they talk about visiting me in prison and all that. And she said, we should go look at some of those articles in the newspaper. Because it was many more bank robberies than that. And so Judge Bilby called me a one-man crime wave. I mean, that's where I was at with this. And, but she wanted to get these articles. And the first article we got, you had to get the microfilm, you know, and then they print it out. And the very first article mentioned that I had robbed the bank for 50 bucks. And she's like, you never said that. Because I'd always like, they would always ask, how much money did you get? I don't know, a couple thousand, you know, like, you know. Yeah, 50, and asked. So I got out of that bank, I ran to my roommate's car, got in my roommate's car, and drove over to 7-Eleven and got a 12-pack of Budweiser. And I, three or four drinks, you know, three or four beers, did everything. It just like calmed me down, like, slow down, little buddy, right, relax. Like, I just stepped into a whole new realm of, like, problems. There's no comeback. It's not like I can walk back in there and give them their 50 bucks back and say, April Fools. It's like November, first off. And so I just decided, well, I just drove across town and robbed another bank. I thought, well, I'm not going to ask for 50 on this one. And about 9 months later, when I got arrested by the FBI, I found out that the second bank I robbed, they were actually doing a bank robbery seminar training, and they got a call for the other one. They packed up and left. 15 minutes later, I drive into that bank and I rob it. And they thought for a second, this guy's got to be a mastermind. Like, he diverted us, you know, like. And I'm sure that was only for a second. And they're like, yeah, no, okay. And so anyway, I went back home. I went to my fiance. I took her out to dinner. I paid all my debts off. Everything, I mean, I'm back to square one. I got a pocket full of money. I'm squared with everybody. And all of a sudden, I feel good. 6 months later, I'm out of money. Tell my boss, hey, I need to take your van. They had this van called Klein Construction. It was like the biggest paint van in the world. It's the worst getaway car ever. And I said, I need to go cash a check at lunchtime. And he gives me the keys to the van. I drive into town, rob a bank, come back, and, you know, like I work the rest of the day. Like, it's in my mind, and I'm actually getting sick around it, thinking, you know, I should do armored cars and. I was a real problem, and I was baffled. Like, they just give you the money. And what I did not know is behind the scenes, there's a whole bunch of people called FBI who's, like, looking around trying to find me. And I came home from work one day. This is about 2 weeks after my third bank robbery. And I came home from work, and on the refrigerator is a picture of me. It doesn't say my name. It's just me. Coming out of my first bank, the first $50 bank robbery, and I was smiling. It looked like I was smiling. I didn't smile, but it was that clear of a picture. So I had no plan. I was just the night before going to kill myself. So, you know, in my defense, I was kind of delirious. And my roommates, because they loved me so much, had said, holy crap, that looks like Brian. And they cut it out and they put it on the refrigerator. And to tell you what type of people I live with, I ripped it down. I was really nervous. I thought, well, this really is me. I even think I had that shirt in my drawer. And I go, what's that? And they go, oh, dude, man, there's some dude running around town, looks just like you, Robin Banks. And I'm thinking, well, if these rocket scientists don't think that's me, then clearly nobody else was. And they had a little $5,000 reward about 2 weeks later, I got arrested. And thank God I got arrested. Now, that does not make me alcoholic. That doesn't make me even remotely. It makes me an idiot. That's all. It makes me an idiot. It makes me a convicted felon. Well, I'm not a convicted felon. I'm a guy who went to prison. But it makes me, it doesn't make me alcoholic. That's what you need to know. My parents got a lawyer. They did whatever parents do. My mom and dad rescued me. They got a lawyer. They bailed me out. And then about a week before I went to trial, I robbed another bank. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you guys are talking about quitting. And I'm like, I don't quit anything. And I didn't even have an answer on why I did that, except I was bummed because I was going to go to prison. My lawyer said, you're going to go to prison for like 10 years. Like, you're 21 years old, and you're a pretty good guy, but truth is, you can't rob three banks and not go to prison. And I heard 10 years, that's 30, 31, then I might as well be dead. Because when you're in your 20s, 30 does seem old. As a 55-year-old man, 30 seems like they should be in diapers. I mean, I'm like, I couldn't see the truth. Robbed the bank, partied all weekend, got arrested, went to prison for 6 years. I didn't do anything in prison. I didn't go to groups, AA, CA. I didn't do anything. I didn't do therapy. I made wine, I drank wine, I smoked weed, I did everything wrong you could do in prison. Thinking when I got out, I was 28 years old, that I'll just not do that again. The war on drugs was high, it was right in motion of that. It was in the 80s when just say no. And so the policies were, well, we'll punish you, which I should have. I was the only guilty guy in prison. I'm going to tell you right now, I was completely guilty, and I deserved to be there. And I deserved to spend every single day in there. I committed a major felony. I'm not a victim of that. I don't complain about that. I had things happen to me in there that, you know what? I put myself in prison. I got out. This is alcoholism. This is when I started to realize I was alcoholic. This is the beginning of me starting to say something's wrong. I'm 28 years old. My buddy says, hey, this is 5 years, 8 months in prison. My buddy says, hey, our 10-year high school reunion is like a month after you get out. We should go. My parole officer had told me I had to go to this 90-day outpatient program. And while I was in this 90-day outpatient program, I wasn't allowed to drink. I knew I had a problem with drugs. It was not a question. I was like, yes, bought in 100%, but I'm not alcoholic. And I said to him, well, I don't even have a problem with alcohol. He said, well, then that's good. You won't have a problem not drinking for 90 days. You know, I'm not a fan of that kind of logic, just want to say. I'm a month sober. I got nothing in my system. I don't want to drink. I mean, I want to drink, but I'm going to commit to not drinking because I don't want to go back to prison. I don't want to violate my terms of condition of release. I don't want to do that. I'm not comfortable in my skin. I got a job. My dad got me a credit card. He got me a car. They set me up for success way more than most guys I did time with who were just onto the streets. I had a loving family that had access to some help, and I blew right through it. And I went to my 10-year reunion. I'll never forget it. I went there. I had no intention of drinking. I was not going to drink. I walked in there, and I felt so uncomfortable. I felt so low. I felt so much just like a failure. And if you wanted to find it, in the doctor's opinion, defines it good. I was restless, irritable, discontent, contented. I was not okay. And it took me about 15 minutes of that intense feeling, and I walked into the bar with my buddy, and I started drinking. And all my resolutions, all my intentions, everything I planned to do, everything I was committed to do was out the window, and I started drinking. And because I have this allergy to alcohol, I get relief on the first drink. First drink, I get this feeling of like, whew. I mean, it settled me, it calmed me. I started to feel better, but I got this abnormal reaction to alcohol, which I did not know about. Nobody told me this. And I couldn't stop. And I went on this run for 8 months, and I ended up doing the same thing I did. I tested positive 3 times. My parole officer called me. He said, we got a problem. You got 3 positive urine tests for cocaine, and you need to come and see me tomorrow. And I said, okay, I will see you at 9 a.m. I went into my room. I was living with my parents. I packed it all up, put it in the car, and drove across town to a friend's and said, I need a place to hide out. I didn't say hide out. I said, I need a place to rent, which means I went underground. 8 months later, federal marshals arrest me coming out of a 7-Eleven. I go back to prison for a year, and the only difference and the only thing that changed was some Al-Anon lady in my mom's bowling league decided to butt into my business and told my mom, you're killing your son. Now, I'm the baby of 4. She buried Chucky, who was 2 years. Her whole life has been about saving me. My first 6 years in prison, I got a letter every day from my dad, a $20 money order every day. $20 for my books. Commissary, 20, 20, 20, every week. And sometimes he'd send a bunch of books, and sometimes, but it was always a little, you know, postal money order from my commissary, $20 a week, and it was always a little note saying, you know, hey, here's this, and blah, blah, some good books, and I love you, Dad. And my when I was in prison, I would get so mad at my dad. Like, why doesn't he just send me $80? Like, why are they trying to control me from there? And years later, I was probably like 10, 11 years sober. I was with my dad golfing. I was doing a trip to Tucson. I think me and Chloe and the family went, or what, I don't know. We were in Tucson, and we were talking, and somehow that came up, and he said, "Do you ever wonder why I did that?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "I just wanted you to get something every single week to let you know that we loved you." And I'm sitting there judging him because he's not doing what I think he should do. And he was doing exactly what he needed to do. And when they called mail that day, this is after I went back, I got arrested and I was waiting for my mail call, waiting for my $20 money order, and there was no money order. It was a letter from my mom and dad, and it was really from my mom. And basically it was saying, "You're on your own. We're not gonna support you anymore. You are on your own. When you get out, you're gonna be living wherever you're gonna live, and we're done sending you money. And we love you, but we're cutting the apron strings. Good luck." And as mad as that made me, up until my mom died, I always let her know, like, you gave me life twice. You brought me into the world in 1962, and in 1991, when you sent me that, that saved my life. Because I ended up at this homeless shelter a year later, and I ended up drinking there. I had $60 to my name. This is alcoholism. I started to see some problems, but I just wasn't willing. When I started to go through the steps with my sponsor, I could identify this, like, well, that clearly is powerlessness. That's powerlessness. But I couldn't see it at the time. I had $60 to my name. That's all I had, $60. I had no more money. That's it. 29 years old, $60. And I go to this homeless shelter place, and they say, you can't drink while you're here. And I had to be there, like, I think three or four months. I still had 8 months of paper. And the very first day they let me out, I ended up in a liquor store buying a bottle of vodka, put it in a brown paper sack, and I walk across the street to the park, and I hang out with all the other guys hanging out in the park, and I started to drink. Made no sense. And my cellmate, like, y'all know what that means, but the guy who I live with, right? I remember, like, 3 or 4 days later, before I left, I remember giving him everything I had. I pushed everything. I said, "Hey, you can sell this. You can pass this." I gave him everything I had, and he said, no. He said, "Hey, Shorty," because that's what they call you when you're short in prison. "Hey, Shorty." I've had so many nicknames. Shorty P was my nickname in prison, you know, and someone calls me Three Piece because of my Kentucky Fried Chicken story now. There was a predator in prison who tried to call me Hot Sauce, but I didn't let that happen. I said, "No, don't be doing that." But he said, "Hey, Shorty, check it out." He said, "I'm just going to leave all this stuff over here. And when you come back in a week or so, you can have it back." And I was like, mad. I'm like, "Why would you do that?" He said, "Look, Brian," he never called me Brian, but he said, "Look, you've been with me in the cell for a year. You've been making wine, drinking wine, smoking weed, using heroin. Like, you've been doing everything. What makes you think you're going to stay sober?" I had every intention. And you know what happened when I got caught? Because I ended up getting caught like 3 days later. And what happened is I was more worried about having to deal with him than going back to prison. I was more worried about what he would say and what they would think. And my parole officer came and he 12-stepped me. And he didn't say he was 12-stepping me. He just staffed me and said, "I'm going to send you to AA. I've been sober in AA for 6 years, Brian, and you're a drug addict, but you're also alcoholic. And until you treat your alcoholism, you're always going to go back to that, and you're never going to stay sober, and you're just going to be a statistic. And they go, "Sending you back for 8 months is not going to fix you, and this is your last chance." And he didn't even know why he did it, and he sent me to you people of all places. And I walked into my first AA meeting, and I was scared. I was more scared going into AA than I was going back to prison. I was so mortified and petrified, and how do you talk sober? And everything about it scared me, but there was something that was undeniable. I could never deny it, that when I walked into my first AA meeting, it was a Northwest Alano Club in Tucson. It was a nooners, smoke-free. The kindness in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous touched my spirit in a way that nothing ever has. could not deny it. And I had been living in a world of violence and hate. And I was so consumed with me and blocked off. It penetrated me. I couldn't even block it anymore. I would want to deny it on the way over to the bus stop, but I couldn't deny it. And people would come and offer me rides. I wouldn't take rides. Like, no. I brought in so many old ideas. Like, if you help me, I owe you. That's how it is in prison. If you help me, if you give me something, then you want something. In AA, that's not the case. And thank God that's not the case. And I started on this journey. I started on this journey thinking that I'm just not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'll just go to meetings. And I went to 2 meetings a day. Got a job in a treatment center. Ended up drinking. Because going to meetings is good. I think going to meetings is required. I remember I asked Don P, like, what's the story about going to meetings? I was trying to trick him to say meetings aren't necessary. He goes, meetings won't keep me sober, but if I don't go to AA meetings, I'll get drunk. That was like Buddhist stuff right there. You're like, what does that even mean? You know, like... And because I didn't want to look like an idiot, I said, yeah, that's what I thought. And we'll move on. But Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, 2 a day, did not get me sober. It didn't keep me sober. I started feeling uncomfortable in AA. I just ran it to the ground and I drank. And then I came back on March 6th of 93. I came back because somebody intervened on me. Someone made my drink in their business and asked me how long I'd been sober, knowing that I hadn't been sober. And he was one of my best friends in AA. He was my road dog in AA. And I tried to lie, and he just stopped me short and said, I love you too much to watch you die. And I ended up getting intervened on, and I got sober. And I asked this guy named Ken W. 2 days later to sponsor me. He was a big book Kenny. And he was one of those guys who carried his big book around and talked about writing inventory and making amends. And he was talking about being a recovered alcoholic. He was the kindest man I've ever met. He was 29 years old. He was my age, 7 years sober. Complete opposite guy that I would ever hang with, and he was a straight-up cowboy from New Mexico. Dually truck, he's a man's man, welder, but he had such a peace about him, and he started to walk me gently through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he told me the truth that this is a spiritual illness. It's physical, it's mental. It demands a spiritual solution. He didn't sugarcoat it. And he walked me line by line through the book, line by line, page by page. I found out that I got a body that does not process liquor correctly, and I got a mind that thinks it does. That's a problem. And it's not the first drink that gets me drunk, because they used to say that, first drink gets you drunk. And I get it intellectually, one leads to two, blah, blah, blah. But I also believe that's not the case. It's the unprotected thought that precedes the first drink. If I don't have any protection against that. And I started to do this process called the 12 steps. And I wrote this inventory. I shared this 5th step. I started to wake up spiritually. But the thing with waking up spiritually, that means I could go back asleep. And you never know you were asleep until you wake up. So the thing is, like... How do I stay connected to this power? And I'm going to tell you, I left treatment with my beautiful wife. We were newly recovered, and we got busy getting an AA. And the only thing he really told me to do, he said, I don't want you moving to Maine, because I made a commitment to move to Maine with Chloe. He said, why don't you just stay here for a year so you can go and make all your amends, or at least go make a majority of your amends. Because I did a 5th step at, I think, 2 months sober, and I started making amends at 4 months sober. I started going out there and Chloe would go on me. I would go to these places, and, you know, like, I mean, I was on federal parole. I was paying back money from places I stole. I was willing to do that. And I got a year, well, we moved to Maine, and we started living life, and we started getting busy. I became a GSR of my home group, started going to district meetings. I got in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous ever since I got sober, right in the middle, even when I don't want to be in the middle. I'm going to tell you some stories, and then I'll close. I don't even know when I started. I'm just going to go until these stories are over. I'm so... I mean, if you're all going on the boat ride, you can't go anywhere anyway, so, you know. And the beach will be there soon, don't worry. I got involved, this lady named Prison Lady Mary, or Prison Mary, I can't remember her name, but she was the district prison coordinator. Actually, she was the area corrections chair. And she heard my story, and she started stalking me and told me that I needed to go into the Maine State Prison, which was about 20 minutes from my house, by the way. I remember I was like, why do I live in Maine? One of those, you know, philosophical, like, trying to, like, deep thoughts, like, why am I in Maine? And I started realizing I am, like, 20 minutes from four different penal institutions, actually five, and at that time I was active in all of them. But I didn't want to go because of this. Some of you heard my little piece I told you yesterday. The truth is, I didn't want to go back to prison because of that. I didn't want to go back in there. And Mary wouldn't have it. She wasn't like taking no. And then I filled out the form. This is how alcoholic I am. I fill out the form, I send it in, and they deny me. And I get indignant. I'm like, what? I'm Shorty P, man. What are you talking about? How are you going to deny me? I go on a writing campaign, you know, to the governor, like, you must let me in, you know. And I got cleared, and I started bringing AA meetings into the prison, and I did that for 15 years, and I did it twice a week. And I started taking men through the steps. I started doing 12-step workshops, taking men, like groups of men. Like there'd be like 15 of us, and we'd do a group third step. And they'd write inventory, and I'd listen to their fifth step. And everything that Don P. told me, everything he said about if you truly want to know God, get to know his kids, because that's where God lives. And I started getting to know God's kids, and I started to see God in the eyes of people. I thought God never existed. So I had been molested when I was 10 by a family member. And I had a prejudgment against guys doing time that had that crime. And one day, this is like a true spiritual experience for me. I'll never forget this. And I'd written inventory on this person a lot. I'd written a lot of inventory on, and I could never really get free. And I owed this person amends. But I wasn't, and I would say I was free. And then one day this guy, I was probably nine years sober, maybe seven, and this guy comes up and says, and I know his crime, I know exactly what he's doing time for, and I never treated him disrespectful. He comes up to me and says, hey, can I get in your next step group? I see guys getting better, and I want to get better. And I'm ashamed to say it. I'm really ashamed to say it. But at that moment, I said, you know what, I'll have to think about that. And I knew it was wrong when I said it, and I knew it was wrong when I walked out the door that day, and I went out to the parking lot and hit my knees and started bawling like a baby, and I knew I'd violated one of God's principles. I know I just kicked one of God's kids in the teeth. And that voice of like, if you love me, then you love my kids. And I called my sponsor and said, I just violated a principle. And he said, what happened? And I told him what happened. He said, wow, that sucks. And he says, well, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to take that man through the steps. I'm going to get him. I'm going to kneel down, hold his hand, and do a third step prayer with him and walk him through this process. And he said, that's cool. And he said, you know what I really like about this? Which I'm like, I don't even know remotely what you could like about this. He said, I just really like the fact that you can't go in for another week to tell him that. Now you get to sit with that. In your pious self, you know, like, oh, I'm all spiritual. And I went and took that man. I came back, and I couldn't get there quick enough. And I sat down with that man, and I took him through the 12 steps, and I listened to his fifth step. And I'm not saying it was easy. It was really hard. He'd done a lot of damage to his kids. It was hard. I had kids. I think so. It must have been over 10 because I had kids. My daughter was born. But I would sit in the parking lot before I went in to listen to his fifth step. I said, God, you got to come with me because I don't have the power not to respond. But he's one of yours. Let your power shine through me. And I sat with that man. I cried with that man. And 2 years after that, and I don't know what happened. I mean, he died of cancer 2 years later. I know he got free somehow, but I'm going to tell you what happened to me was that resentment, I've never had the right sense. I got free by being of service to one of God's kids. And I get caught up in the mechanics of the book. I got to write inventory, I got to write four-column inventory, what my mistakes are. And the truth is, I can do all that, but sometimes it's the actions I take. And the action I took that time was having compassion and kindness for a child of God. And it saved my life. I was able to make amends for that man. I I'm going to tell you two more stories. And I'm in this one, you want me to end, we'll just end. Just say it. Nobody said no. That's always concerning. That was like a self-seeking statement. You're always waiting for one person. No, keep going. Everyone's like, yeah, it's freaking on here, you know? Like, I feel really blessed, you know, like really blessed. I made amends to my mom. I'll tell you a story about my mom and the healing. But, you know, my dad died 2012. I moved to Texas in 2011, and Chloe and the kids stayed in Maine. I moved there by myself while the kids were in school, and they were going to come in June, and we bought this house. I mean, this is how much trust we have for each other. Chloe never even saw the house. She saw it online. She said, I trust you. I bought a house. She didn't even see it. She looked at the picture. She goes, it looks good. What do you think? I said, yeah. April of 2012, and I had been taught by this guy about meditation, about really, truly tapping into the intuitive thought, this vital sixth sense that we talk about in the 11th step. Like, do I, you know, because Bill, if you think Bill wrote the big book by himself, if you didn't think he went into deep meditation and came out and let God write the book, you're crazy. Because I know what a 2-year sober guy looks like, right? Because when I was 2 years sober, that every chapter would have been as Brian sees it. You know, like there's, you know, Brian's opinion, you know. I met a doctor once, but here's my opinion of his opinion. And, you know, my solution, you know. My view on more about alcoholism, you know. I was an agnostic. I mean, this is how it would have been written, so I'm clearly. And so I started buying into this 20-minute meditation to really tap into this innermost self, to really drive thoughts and actions by this voice within and to keep a true connection to the power. And I came out of meditation. My dad had been having some medical problems. I came out of meditation, and the voice within said, go see your dad. And I just started a new job. I didn't have any PTO. I didn't have any time off. He said, go see your dad. And I called my brother, and I said, hey, Dwayne, I said, you know, he was just with my dad. And I said, how's dad doing? He said, oh, he's fine. He's out of the hospital. He's living at mom's. Everything's great. I said, you think I should go see him? He said, no, he's good. You've got that job. Stay with that. Called my mom same way. But I couldn't get this voice out of my head. And so I called up the guy I work for, and I said, hey. And I got sober with this guy, so he's in AA, he knows it. And I said, hey, you know, I just did this, blah, blah, blah. And he says, absolutely go. And I flew out to Tucson to see. And what I found when I walked into my mom's house was, my mom said my dad was dehydrated and he was sleeping in the bed and he's fine. But what I realized is she saw what she was looking for. She was married to that man for 56 years. And what the truth was is he was dying in her bed. And I climbed into my dad. I climbed in. And my dad had black hair with really blue eyes. And I said to him, I remember wiping his forehead. I said, hey, Dad, it's Brian. And he just kind of came out of it and looked at me, and he said, I'm really proud of you, son. And as a son who took his parents through the gutter with him, who took his parents to prison with him, that meant everything to me. And we took him to the emergency room the next day. I told my mom, like, no, he's dying. I went to the, I have a few phobias. One, I don't like loose hair, like loose, just floating hairs freak me out, right? Just saying. You know, and if you're married, you know, the wife who has long hair, they in the shower, they comb it out, they put it on the wall, like not, can't handle it. Like, and I don't like toenails, right? I don't know why, I just have issues with toenails. And we were in the hospital, and we were all there, my oldest brother, my mom, and my other brother, and they pulled the sheet back, and I saw my dad's toenails, and I got instant resentment, because the toenails were kind of curling over. And nobody had been taking care of my dad. And I was furious. And I also knew that my mom was in a state of being, that wouldn't help anything if I got mad. So I just sat there in this position of like, that's not okay. That's my dad. And it was time to leave, and everybody left, and I ended up not leaving. I circled back, and I went up, and the nurse asked me what I'm doing there. And I said, have you seen my dad's toenails? And she said, yes, I have. I said, I'm not leaving until I cut those. And I spent the next 30 minutes with this nurse who I'd never met, cutting my dad's toenails and cleaning his feet. I knew he was going to die. And I wanted that man to die with dignity. And he died not even a week later. And my mom asked me to do the eulogy. And he died with dignity. As a father should. As a man should. As a human should. I'll tell you this. I made amends to my mom. This is... When I made amends to my mom, I was taught to say, here's, you know, I started paying back money. I told him what I owned everything. These are my mistakes, blah, blah, blah. And I asked her if there's anything she wants to say to me. And she said, yeah, there's absolutely lots of things I want to say to you. And she said, let me tell you something. That letter that I wrote to you, it was harder to write that letter than it was to bury your brother. Now, I wasn't a father at this time, but I'm telling you, that knocked the wind out of my sail. That hit me in a place that has never left. And when she explained it, she said, look, when Chucky got cancer, it was 1966. We just gave him to the doctors. We said, fix our baby. We were powerless. We didn't know. We're not doctors. We just let him. And then for a year, he was in and out, in and out, in and out. And then he died. She goes, but with you, I had a choice. And she goes, I wrote that letter on a Monday, put it in the mailbox that morning, went in, had my cup of coffee, and then 5 minutes later, I pulled it out of the mailbox. She goes, I did that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. She goes, I did that every day until Friday. As I got up to go get it out of the mailbox, your dad put his hand on my shoulder and said, let him go. She goes, I cried all weekend. And I remember thinking internally, like, there's no words that can ever, ever fix that. It's only the actions that I live. And I made a commitment to God and to me. I didn't make it to her, besides my amends, which was, you know, do my best to be the best son that I can be, was that I was always going to live by the principles that she wanted me to live by. I was always going to be there for her. And I think I honored that. I know I honored that. And she died 2 years after my dad died. And she died, and I'll never forget it. Chloe and I were on our way over to see my mom. It was the year she died. We didn't know she was going to die. She wasn't sick or anything. And we hadn't stayed at my mom's house in a long time because my mom's a little crazy, untreated alcoholic, Al-Anonish, you know. And so we'd always stay at a condo, and then we'd visit her. And then when we got, you know, filled up, we'd leave. But it was always that way, and it was no big deal. I mean, it was always, we gave her lots of love and everything. And this year, Chloe says to me, we should stay at your mom's house. I don't know why she said it. She said, we should actually stay at her house. I said, really? She said, yeah, she's probably lonely. And that's the year we stayed at her house, and my mom was so happy we stayed at her house. She was so grateful we stayed, and we brought the kids, and she had her grandkids there. And then 5 months later, she got pneumonia, got MRSA in the hospital, and died, never came out. So I beg you to listen to the intuitive thought. I beg you to listen to the voice within. And the only way I can really know it's God's voice is by to stay free of resentments and fears, to have a clean house. And this is my kids are here. And I understand when Mara was talking about love of kids, there's nothing. That beats the love of a parent for their child. Nothing. But men and boys and girls are so different. And I'll close with this little nippet. It was just classic boy-girl stuff. I was sponsoring all these men in prison, and you know, they're like, these guys are like neck tattoos. You know, they're like big guys, and we're all talking war stories. And Chloe says, you know, Quincy's going to find out that you've been in prison. She's pretty precocious. And my daughter loved all these guys, and they loved my daughter. She was like a little 7-year-old, so I had this intuitive thought, like, I think I'll tell her tonight. We're going to go skiing tomorrow, And all day, it'll be me and her in the car, 2 hours to the ski resort, lifts all day, drive home, she'll ask me a million questions. It'll be awesome. And Chloe goes, that's probably a good idea. So I walk Quincy upstairs, and I kneel in front of her, and she's 7 years old. If you met my daughter, she's now 15. And she's like, just a very precocious, loving child. And I look in her eye, and I said, hey, Quincy, I'm going to tell you something about me. And I tell her, I said, you know, when I was a young man, I did some bad things, and I went to prison for 7 years. And she started bawling. I had that thought, like, too soon? You know, like. And she wipes her little tears, and I said, what's going on, sweetie? And she just wipes them away, and she says, you must have been so lonely. You must have been so lonely, Dad. And I go, if you only knew. And she goes, is that why you go into the prison all the time to help these guys? Like, she knows. Asked my son. I told my son. He said, oh, cool. Can, you know. That's the depth that he's got going on. Cool. So I'll leave with this. I love all of you deeply. I especially love the God within all of you and the God that saves us and pulls us back from the gates of insanity. Thank you so much for the invite. God bless you.